I look forward to two fun hours where we learn a lot about our judicial system and answer your questions, have some fun along the way. Usually starts with Mike Leonard, and he's here with us right now. Mike, how are you doing, my friend?
John, great to see you. Excited to be here, although I think I might need a note from you. Can you give me a note?
A note? What do you mean? Like a song note? Like a
no,
ABCs?
A different type of note, kind of when you're in trouble note. So
okay. We're
hosting Easter tomorrow, right?
Right.
So I should be home cleaning, helping get supplies, all this stuff. But I'm here with you, John. So can you give me like a dispensation?
I will, absolutely.
Okay.
You know, dear Leonard family.
Yes. More like just to my wife. The kids don't care, John.
Right.
Yeah.
It is my authority as host of this radio program. I needed Mike here. There's a lot happening in the judicial world. There's no one else I trust to break it all down. He had to be here in person. This could not be done over
the phone.
Exactly.
Could not be done telephonically.
It could not
be done
over the phone. Yeah. And please just make him work extra hard tomorrow morning.
That sounds very convincing, John. You must have written a lot of fake notes when you were a student to try to get out of class.
Never, for your friends.
Can we start with the listener questions for John Hansen?
And for those that don't know, Mike always asks me questions. He's often polling people that he knows, wondering not only just questions for him, but then what people want to know about me. So go ahead.
John, really, it's your reach. It's nothing to do with me. As I travel around, everyone has questions about John Hansen.
Okay.
So I tried to distill it down today because there's just a stack of them.
Okay, but right.
We're going to go with John. Everyone seems to want to know if you rated your top three Easter candies. Give me your one, two, and three. And no hesitating here.
I would definitely go with like the Cadbury Easter egg, right? The one
solid,
that has the filling on the inside
choice,
or cream in the
very
inside.
Very solid, yes.
Skittles are always my candy there, but they're not like an Easter candy.
That's not an Easter candy, John.
Fine, jelly beans at number two.
Okay, I'll take that. We'll pretend you didn't say anything about Skittles.
Fine, and then I'm okay with Peeps. I'll put them at number three.
Peeps? Interesting.
They're not my favorite, but I will eat them. I don't find them objectionable like some people do.
Yeah, I have a strong position on Peeps. I mean, you got to eat one every Easter just because it's Easter, but I think they're horrible.
Okay.
But I do eat one or two just because you have to.
Right.
You're required to. I know you want to know what I
wanna
think,
know,
John.
In return,
I know.
Of course.
Jelly beans, one. Those chocolate eggs with the marshmallow in the side, two.
Okay.
And then I'd probably go the malted milk ball things. They look like eggs, you know? Those are pretty solid.
Those are pretty solid, exactly. Yeah. And there's like a different texture as you go through the candy, right? It's like a little, it changes as it goes.
It's kind of exciting. Yeah.
That's great.
So that's all I got for you. I mean, I had a stack of questions. Yeah. I just distilled it down, John.
Only because time for one.
We could spend all day with John Hansen listener questions.
I do have a question of the day today, Mike.
Sure.
And actually, I'll make you eligible for it.
Oh, okay.
I never let the guests be eligible.
Don't make me eligible because you know I'm not
going
to get it.
That's kind of what I'm going for. But here it is. 20 years ago, the American Civil Liberties Union of Georgia was in the news this week for fighting to allow people to protest what? It was 20 years ago this week, the American Civil Liberties Union of Georgia was in the news for fighting to allow people to protest what? Let's give the listeners an option first.
Well, sure, but I have no clue.
Okay,
so let's just
so
be fair. I'm not going to pretend. I know you like to do the Alex Trebek on the listeners where you know it, you know, but I'm not going to do that, John.
312-981-7200. If you can tell me 20 years ago this week what the American Civil Liberties Union of Georgia was in the news for fighting just to allow people to protest what? We'll get you a prize. Let's do the WGN Radio t-shirt if you want to do that. 312-981-7200.
Why not the John Hansen mug? I think that's a popular item, John.
Iridian's on it. Okay. We don't have much of a budget for that. That would come out of the John Hansen budget, not the WGN budget.
As we've previously discussed in your, quote, green room, you charge the vending machine. So I know there's not a huge budget, John. Well, we've already covered that, right? And I got all the executives at WGN angry.
I'm going to leave that one where it is. You know, if you want me, I can spot you the $1.50 for the Diet Coke.
No, it's more fun to talk about it on air, how cheap you are. Yeah.
312-981-7200 if you have an answer to the question of the day or questions about anything else. Let's talk a little first about, we got to do it. It's the Trump case, obviously. He was indicted, arrested, you know, and fingerprinted, I assume, and went through the whole arraignment. Just your reaction to the day that was. It was certainly a spectacle. Everyone really covered it. And what are your thoughts, just generally speaking?
Yeah, I think a lot of people thought, what an underwhelming indictment. You know, I think we had really hoped for and expected some meat to it, right? And, you know, the thing that was troublesome, I thought, is that he's essentially, as you know, charged with what are otherwise misdemeanor charges under New York state law, made felonies.
Why?
Because the bookkeeping record violation is a misdemeanor, okay? Under that statute, it becomes a felony if you're creating the false record in furtherance of some other crime. So you have to be committing, attempting to commit some other crime or concealing some other crime for it to become a felony.
Did Alvin Bragg lay out what that other crime is?
No, that's the crazy thing. So obviously, as a defense attorney, as a lawyer, even as from the client's perspective, one of the hallmarks of due process is getting fair notice of what you're charged with, okay? So Trump got notice of what he's charged with, but the legal theory was really just explained by Alvin Bragg during a press conference, essentially saying, well, it could be a violation of New York campaign laws. It could be a violation of federal election law. So instead of pleading in the indictment what the other crime was, he didn't do that, which I think really, you know, I know President Trump's out there saying, hey, it's going to get dismissed. Clearly, there is a good faith motion for to dismiss the indictment, you know, for not providing fair notice of what the charges that he faced. And the reality is, in both state and federal court, you know, we often file motions to dismiss indictment.
Mm-hmm.
Typically, they're narrow legal issues. For instance, you know, the statute of limitations bars the government from bringing
like
this charge.
Specific thing.
Or you might argue that it's unconstitutional or it's unconstitutional as charged. Some legal issue, you can't get into facts. You can't say, hey, I didn't do it, or the facts aren't as you say. So typically motions to dismiss are denied, but clearly there's going to be a robust motion to dismiss filed in this case. And I wouldn't be surprised if the court either, you know, grants in part to say, you know, you need to provide more particulars as to the crime, which is kind of...
So they would give the DA a chance to say, well, what's this other crime that you didn't lay out in the indictment that
correct.
We have?
I mean, theoretically, they could dismiss the indictment as legally insufficient. More likely, they might grant a motion for what's called a bill of particulars, where the government has to give you additional facts or certainly the legal theory upon which you are charged. So I think, with, like a lot of commentators do, it was underwhelming. It was surprising. And the problem that does create also, it does create this idea that it's a selective prosecution, right?
Right.
And so typically, you know, to make an argument or motion that to dismiss a case for selective prosecution, it's usually based on such thing as a protected status, like race-based or something like that. Mm-hmm. This is pretty unique. I think the theory is going to be, hey, this prosecutor, said before he, or allegedly said while he was running, that he was going to charge Trump. Here he does. Most people are not charged with these violations under New York law. Certainly most people are not charged with a felony.
Right.
So I think it's problematic, and I hate to say it, but I think, you know, when Trump was making all these public statements about the indictment itself, not about the judge and all that stuff, I think that was really inappropriate. But there certainly is a strong basis for a motion to dismiss.
My question is that, and I heard a lot of people say, yes, but he's not required to give all that information in that indictment, and more is coming, and we'll find out more as it goes. Do you think that, A, could be true, and also, B, at the same time, still irresponsible not to lay it all out?
Yeah, I think you should lay it all. When you have a case that's getting this level of publicity, lay it out. Let the public know what your legal theory is. Let the defendant know what your legal theory is. But the reality is, most judges aren't going to dismiss an indictment. They might make the prosecutor give more particulars, which could lead to another motion, but typically they're not going to grant the motion to dismiss.
But I do want to say, and you said it quickly there, all the other stuff that the former president is saying, posting photos, his lawyers going out there and his family saying a bunch of stuff about the Bragg family, that you feel is...
Oh, that's out of bounds, right? I mean, you should never attack the judge or make personal attacks upon the judge. It really just undermines the system. And so from all we've heard about this judge, and he presided over the Trump Business Organization mm-hmm. trial, everybody says universally that he's very fair, he's measured, he's thoughtful, he's not an activist, you know, he really thinks about everything deeply, reads everything, you know, the things that you want a judge to do. So when you go out there and say, you know, he's a liar or his family's, you know, has this connection or that connection, it just really undermines the system in general. I don't support that.
As a defense attorney, would it bother you that he donated $15 to President Biden's 2020 campaign, $10 to the Progressive Turnout Project, and to another $10 to a group called Stop Republicans?
Well, sure. I mean, any defense counsel who has a case before a judge, if they see a bent, if they have a client who's a political figure and they see a bent towards the other side, of course that's going to raise questions. I mean, the amounts of monies are so small, you wonder why the judge even donated
them. Most judges are
wise enough not to donate any money either way to political causes.
It's his prerogative. I mean, it's his First Amendment right to do so.
But it's a really easy excuse. I'm a judge. Yeah. I don't want to perceive this bias. What it does, it's not a direct conflict, right? But it just creates the appearance of impropriety. That's right. The problem.
And I just want to say this, having you laid out that whole case, and people that listen to this program know, just to put a point on it, you're not a big President Trump fan. This is not you trying to rally to the president's defense.
No. So, yeah, if there's your listener said, I've never been a Trumpie. I'm not a big supporter or fan. But from a defense lawyer standpoint and a public justice fan, right, I don't think that the indictment is very solid. I think it's troublesome the way it was pled. And so I do have real problems with the indictment. I don't care who the defendant is. You know, I can look at that objectively and say, look, in this case, I think it's real problematic for the government.
Right. And there's other potential indictments coming for President Trump that you see are more strong.
Yeah. I made the prediction, John, about a year ago that he wouldn't get charged in connection with the Mar-a-Lago documents, although there's been some leakage about what he might have known or done to cover up. But I still predict there won't be an indictment arising out of Mar-a-Lago. The Georgia issue, who knows what's going to happen there. But yeah, there's potential for multiple cases against Trump. There's no doubt.
And you'll analyze them each for us as if, then, when they come.
Absolutely. Looks like we got some listeners calling in, John.
We do, but we got to pay the bills, as we say.
Oh, you got to have ads.
Yeah.
Okay.
Jim and Robert, hang on the line. We'll get to your questions after this. This is Let's Get Legal, powered by the Illinois State Bar Association on WGN. Let's Get Legal, powered by the Illinois State Bar Association. Someone wanted me to repeat the question of the day. 20 years ago this week, the American Civil Liberties Union of Georgia was in the news for fighting for allowing people to protest what? There was a fight about where people could or couldn't protest a very specific thing at a specific place, and the American Civil Liberties Union of Georgia stepped up. So tell us what we're talking about. 312-981-7200. A lot of questions on the line. We're going to go to Robert first. Robert, you're on with Mike Leonard. How you doing, Robert?
Doing good.
What's your question?
I had a question for Mike.
Yep.
I was wondering if Mike Leonard has ever had a client who, you know, obviously not the notoriety of the President Trump, but has considerable notoriety, media, and it invokes strong feelings, either pro or against. Mm. And how does that factor into how you defend the case?
That's a great question, Robert. Mike, you got 90 seconds.
Yeah, well, it's definitely something you have to keep in mind if you happen to have the client who has a lot of fame or infamy, and you want to manage your messaging, so to speak. I mean, the judge in New York, for example, in the Trump case, kind of gave some vague admonitions to the parties about what they can say and not say. But it doesn't look like that's going to be robustly enforced. It seems like he's going to let people kind of do what they want publicly.
Right.
So what you want to do, to the extent you're allowed to under the rules, you know, manage that message. You know, you can talk to the media. You can put your client in the best foot forward. You can answer all the questions that don't get into evidentiary issues or discovery or things like that. But clearly, you want to do what you can to shape public opinion. The problem as an attorney is there's a rule, as Robert knows, that you could run afoul of if the court thinks you're trying to influence the potential jury. Mm. It's hard when you're so far away from trial in a case like this. But
true.
Clearly, that's what everyone's trying to do. They're trying to get their message out to potential jurors.
Would it be extremely rare for a defense side to be issued a gag order?
I wouldn't say it's rare. I mean, I think lots of judges, particularly in the federal system, would certainly not let happen what's happening so far in the Trump case. They would, you know, potentially have hearings on it. They might subject someone to a contempt order. They might have a very specific order about, can they address the media at all, and kind of parameters on what they can say. And I think that might become necessary in that case.
Yeah. I mean, I think the onus would have to be on the government to really show why that he shouldn't be able to, only because, you know, he got his First Amendment rights,
yeah,
right?
It's hard. Well, yeah, it's interesting because the ethical rules don't govern the client. The ethical rules govern what the lawyer can say and what the lawyer's doing to influence the case and the jury. In Trump case, when he's making attacks upon the family, clearly, I think the judge would have an interest in putting some rope around Trump.
We appreciate the call, Robert. I do want to get one guest in here right before the news. Question of the day. 20 years ago, ACLU of Georgia in the news for fighting to allow people to protest what? Jim, what's your question?
Well, my question
your answer,
is I think they were protesting the Confederate flag on the state flag of Georgia.
What a great guess. Just not the answer to the question of the day. 312-981-7200. If you want to try and get a WGN Radio t-shirt, we'll have more of that and more questions for Mike Leonard after the news here on WGN. By the way, WGN Radio now has an online store. I'm sure you heard about this. If not, just letting you know, we have our very own collection on the WGN TV storefront. Mix of tees, I got sweatshirts, I got mugs. No John Hansen mug, though, Mike Leonard. At least yet. Variety of colors, fits, and styles. All with a few versions of the WGN Radio logo. You choose what you want, and it all gets shipped to you directly. Go to WGNradio.com/store.
John, I'm going to make a mug for you at one of those like ceramic stores.
Please do.
And bring it in.
Please do.
Okay.
Make one for Iridian, too.
All right.
All right, let's go to Patrick, who has a guest to the question of the day, which was about 20 years ago this week, the American Civil Liberties of Union of Georgia was in the news for fighting to allow people to protest. What, Patrick?
At that time, they were getting ready to have the G8 summit, so they were wanting to protest, and Georgia was wanting to force everyone to have permits, and basically it was the right to free speech and to protest.
Interesting. You might be right with that. It's just not the answer I was looking for, Patrick. I didn't know that that was part of the G8 summit in Atlanta. I'll have to look that one up. It's a great guess, just not the answer. All right, let's go to another question here from the phone line. Let's go to Matthew on line 3. Hey, Matthew.
Hello, Michael, I have a question for you. What are some of the key challenges that distinguish a bench trial from a jury trial, and how do you go about determining what's the best route for your client?
Let's define first bench trial. What does that mean, Mike?
Sure. So a bench trial is simply where the case is tried to a judge, right? There's no jury at all.
Does every defendant have a right to choose that?
Well, so yes and no. So in the federal system, where I typically have trials, you can have a bench trial if both sides agree.
Uh-huh.
So you'd have to have the U.S. Attorney's Office agree, and you'd have to want the bench trial. And you wouldn't always want that to be the case, because a lot of times you think, hey, I have a better shot with the jury. Can I even hang the jury? So you oftentimes don't really have much of an option in federal court. It's going to be a jury trial.
Mm-hmm.
State court, you can request a bench, right? And so that's much more common. I'd say in state court criminal cases, yeah, it's still probably maybe 30 to 20%. I'm giving an unscientific guess, but much more typical in state court than in federal court.
Okay.
So the challenge is in a jury trial, I mean, at every stage, I mean, number one, it's the most fun thing that you can do professionally, in my view, right?
Mm-hmm.
Just to be in front of a courtroom, the fact that you have a system that allows, you know, 12 strangers off the street to come in, hear a case they know nothing about,
mm-hmm.
haven't heard a thing about usually, don't even care necessarily about, and just sit there and hear all the evidence and then deliberate. And especially if you win, the fact that you can say, wow, the system works, you know, that these people can come in here, hear the evidence, be fair and unbiased, and render a verdict in favor of your client. But I think the challenge in a jury trial, you just have to be cognizant of the presence of the jury in everything that you do, right? So especially in a criminal case, you know, they're staring at you the whole time. You're talking to them indirectly. You get to talk to them in your opening statement. You want to gear that message to them in your opening statement. You want to be mindful of what's persuasive, what's too long, how you use images, how you tell a story.
So there's a stage aspect to it, a performance aspect in a jury trial that maybe doesn't exist in a bench trial.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, the funny thing is, you know, if you're in front of a judge and it's a bench trial and there's no jury and you're getting all worked up or dramatic, oftentimes they're like, hey, counsel, I get it. I don't need that. I can understand that. And I had it recently happen to me where I had it was like a business-related dispute bench trial, and I was getting kind of worked up, and the judge's like, you know, I can decide about that. I'm like, I go, and I just stop the judge. When a jury's here, it's really effective, you know, just kind of made a joke of it. But, you know, there's far less drama. But I think just being cognizant of the presence of the jury and the fact that that's your audience and you're telling the story to through all of your evidence. So you have to be mindful of how your witnesses come across, how you come across. Are you too hard on a witness in cross-exam? Are you making it succinct? Are you making your points so they can understand them? So you're worried about them and thinking about them the entire time.
Mm-hmm.
And the funny thing is, it's just in the first instance, you know, difficult to select, because especially in federal court trials, you oftentimes don't get a lot of opportunity to ask a lot of questions yourself.
Right.
In state court, you do. And so you're getting a group of people you don't know a lot about, and you're constantly worried about them throughout the whole trial.
Okay, let's go to Jim. Thanks for the call, by the way, Matthew. Jim, you're on WGN. What's your question for Mike?
Hey, Mike. I know this is kind of a really touchy subject with a lot of people, but I'm just curious how we got here with the Texas judge ruling on that, I'm going to mispronounce it, mifepristone drug, the abortion drug. You know, and like, it just looks like, you know, I just did like some Googling, and it looks like there's like 800 federal judges in the country. I could be wrong on that if Google's not telling me the right thing. But does this judge just decide to rule on his own, like without a case in front of him? And can they do that? Or
so you're wondering, like how this happens, where someone can bring up a case and judges overrule other federal judges?
Yeah, 100%. And then also, how do you know? Can any federal judges rule on anything at any time? Like, you know, it doesn't seem kind of open itself up for like, you know, activist rulings and a biased court. Like, what's next? You know, it doesn't seem, you know, we're just opening ourselves up to just, you know, random judges deciding our rights and rules.
I got your question here, Jim.
It's a great question, because, you know, this happens a lot. And clearly, first of all, as Jim has mentioned, there's always got to be a case, right? There has to be a case or controversy to bring to
get in the court. A federal judge can't just say I woke up feeling like this today, I overrule you.
But what Jim's referring to is a very calculated effort to do what's called venue shopping. Pick a particular venue in the country that has enough tie to bring the case in that jurisdiction, right? So that there's a basis to bring the case in that jurisdiction, but they're clearly shopping for a jurisdiction that is favorable or perceived to be favorable to their position.
Mm-hmm.
So that's difficult, because, you know, you could theoretically file a case in any federal jurisdiction in the country, and you could venue shop to try to find the best one and attempt to get a judge within that jurisdiction that leans your way on an issue, or you know they lean your way. The safeguard is, though, these are district court judges, right? So it doesn't matter where you file that action in the country. The problem is, they can make a ruling, and they can issue a stay or do something else that have a national effect on a particular issue. Sometimes not.
Right.
So the safeguard is then the federal appellate court. But as I think Jim is getting to the issue, that's going to take time. So if a federal district court judge rules on an issue and it has a national impact, you know, let's say there's a stay or something, or orders put in place enjoining a certain activity,
mm-hmm.
that's not going to get, you know, readdressed until it goes to the appellate court, which could take months, could take a year. And in the interim, right, that stay may or may not be effective in terms of its national or local scope, right? And, you know, Jim raises his point, why is one federal district court have so much power? Sometimes they might make a ruling that other federal district courts won't follow.
Mm-hmm.
So you have all sorts of differing opinions on the same issue.
Right, and judges often rule for something local, like it's happening here. I ruled this big, but when it comes to federal drugs, it becomes a bigger thing.
Yeah.
I just want to mention that we're talking about the judge out of Texas ruling that the FDA improperly approved of the abortion pill, I'm not saying it right either, more than 20 years ago. But within hours of that decision, a U.S. district judge in Washington, in a separate case, sought to block the FDA from pulling the drug from the market and saying that they can't. So now we have two conflicting cases within hours of each other. What is the FDA supposed to do? I mean, these are pretty unprecedented situations. There's not really a roadmap, is there?
No. Well, these are like flagrantly attempts to, you know, get into a jurisdiction to decide a question one way. So this often happens, though, where you have differing opinions from district courts in a country. Then what's going to happen next is both of those decisions are going to get appealed. And the interesting thing is those are from different circuits, right?
Mm-hmm.
So just to explain that briefly, in Chicago, for instance, we're in the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, which covers Wisconsin, Indiana, Illinois. Texas is in a completely different circuit, and Washington and California are another circuit.
Mm-hmm.
So both those cases are going to get taken up to appellate courts, and it's possible that there may be differing rulings from those two appellate courts, right? So then what's the solution? Then the Supreme Court has to decide. But the point is, you know, in the interim, until it gets to this highest court, there'll be mass confusion, essentially, and differing opinions from judges throughout the whole country. So what you hope happens is that these cases get accelerated on the appellate docket so we can get decisions by appellate courts. And then if they differ from each other, it can get to the Supreme Court. But as you know, all that's going to take time.
But if the federal judge in Texas says you have to take this off the shelves, FDA.
Correct.
And the Washington says you are barred from taking this off the shelves, FDA.
Yeah.
What does he get? I mean, like, literally, like, because if people don't follow judicial rules and laws, things start to break down. We don't want that. But if it's conflicting.
Well, yeah. And theoretically, the judge in Texas who issued the ruling, if they don't follow that, He could hold them in contempt.
Right.
He could hold a hearing. But most likely what's going to happen practically is there's going to be an expedited appeal, probably of both of those decisions.
Yeah.
But as we said, we'll probably get two different rulings from two different federal appellate courts, and then ultimately we'll go to the Supreme Court. So Jim brings out a great question.
A lot of great questions, yeah. Right. And 216 has a follow-up. What qualifies a judge with no medical training whatsoever to rule on something so critical of which they have no expertise? I guess I would say 216 is judges rule on things they don't have expertise on all the time.
Yeah.
They trust the arguments being made in front of them and the experts there to make those decisions. And this is the system we've got, right? And I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know an alternative, right?
Well, it is a great question, though, but this does happen all the time.
Technology,
it might be
like whatever,
a business dispute, a patent dispute, all sorts of things that particular judge may have no career experience. They might have been entire career as a prosecutor. They might have been a civil litigator. They may know nothing about that, but they're confronted with those issues all the time. So that is the system we have, so to speak. But it's troublesome time. Like, how can this judge possibly be an expert in these issues in a short amount of time? It's a very good question.
It's like a radio show host, right?
Yeah, how do you
trust
it all,
you guys?
No, how do you do it all?
I don't. I just trust you guys or finance experts Monday through Thursday to tell me a little bit more. We got to take a break. We'll try and get to one more call, too, before we have the news a little bit later on here on Let's Get Legal, powered by the Illinois State Bar Association on WGN. First of all, Mike Leonard, who should be calling you if they need you?
Everybody, John, everybody. No, people who are in need of criminal representation, or someone who's a whistleblower, meaning they have a claim against their company for blowing the whistle on wrong activity. But as you know, we focus primarily on trying federal and state criminal cases, you know, probably 80% federal criminal cases, and oftentimes certainly state court criminal cases, and then representing individuals in those whistleblower civil cases.
Leonard at TrialLawyers.com. Where can people reach you? What phone number?
312-380-6559.
One more time.
312-380-6559. Is that a good radio voice, John?
That's pretty good.
Okay.
Not great, but it's getting there.
I'm
you've been on the show about a year now.
I probably have to lay it on thick, John, to have a radio voice like you.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, there
that's
you go.
That's not your natural voice, is it?
I think it is.
Okay. We'll take that up later.
Rapid fire questions. Jim is on deck. Bonnie is up to bat right now. Bonnie, what is your question?
Hi, my question is a curiosity question. The only kind of court I've been to is traffic court, and not lately, because I've learned to pay attention to my driving.
There you go, Bonnie.
however, I'm curious, are there courts where there's a trial going on that is a civil trial, or that a person could just go in and observe?
Oh, like actually physically go like to civil or criminal court?
Yes.
All right, let's answer it.
Absolutely, Bonnie. Thanks for the question. So literally every day of the week for civil cases, you could go to the Daly Center downtown. You know, if you ask the bailiffs downstairs, they could probably direct you to where there's a trial going. There's probably every day of the week there's a civil trial going. It's hard sometimes to, you're kind of coming in the middle, right? So it's hard to know what's the right time to come in. And quite frankly, not all aspects of the trial are exciting.
Right.
So you kind of got to get lucky. But in the federal system, the same thing applies. There's civil cases being tried, likely on a weekly basis as well. And it's a little bit easier to get information about those.
And it's free to attend?
Oh, you can walk in any day of the week. Yeah, you just come in, go through security, and you can go. You can watch the whole trial. You can watch parts. You can come in and out.
It's important.
But yeah, it's every trial in America is public. Right. So that's a good question.
I mean, the high profile ones, sometimes there's too many people trying to get in.
Yeah,
right?
There'll be lines and they'll limit it. But yeah, but generally, right, most trials are not well attended.
Bonnie, you want to go to court together one day?
Yes, I'd love to.
Yeah, it'd be fun. All right. I'll see you there.
Maybe John could broadcast live from outside the courthouse. Bonnie, what do you think?
Yeah, that'd be fun.
It would be fun.
All right, Bonnie, I'm glad you're not in traffic court anymore. Let's go to Jim. Jim, you've been holding a while. What's your question for Mike?
So in the Trump case, the New York case,
mm-hmm,
you were talking about that it became a felony because it has to be in the furtherance of another crime.
Right.
Does he have to prove that other underlying crime?
Yeah, great question.
How does that work?
Yeah. My understanding, Jim, and let's face it, I'm not a New York state court lawyer, but yes, I think they'd have to prove the violation of the other offense, which could be very difficult to do. And you're pointing out some other good issues that have been raised by Trump's counsel and Trump himself, is that can the other felony that he's alleged to have violated, you know, can it really be a federal election law question. Does he really have jurisdiction to argue that under the New York statute, it's appropriate to base your claim, the felony claim, on a violation of federal law? I don't think that's ever been decided by a New York court. You know, yeah. So
basically what you're saying is the reason why these aren't misdemeanors, are felonies, they're felonies, is because the DA says it's in furtherance of another crime.
Correct.
Even though he did not outline what it is. But in order to prove that that is a felony, you have to prove the other crime as well.
That's my understanding. Okay. And Jim, if I'm wrong, then call John Hansen.
Yeah. You can join me in court. Really quickly, before I let you go, 773, I had jury duty. I was called to courtroom for a criminal case. Why is the defendant allowed to hear that process when the attorney's questioning the jurors?
Oh, because that's a fundamental constitutional right. So any defendant has always has to be present for every stage of the proceeding, right? And they have input. You know, you confer with your client about jury selection. Like, you know, like, hey, I might tell my client, I got a bad feeling about that guy or that woman. And my client might be, oh, no, I love that person. I really want them on the jury. And sometimes you have a very active debate where you're trying to convince your client, I don't think he's good for our case.
Right.
Or your client's telling me, no, we really need to have them.
But overall, the defendant is allowed to be there for the entire thing. That is their right.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's an important part of the proceedings, picking the jury. It could have a huge outcome on your case, of course.
For sure. Mike Leonard, we're out of time. Fill the full hour, as always.
We have one question remaining. We can't do it in 10, 15 seconds?
We can't.
Oh, my God.
Mike,
Ad revenue.
Where could people reach you at?
312-380-6559. And, John, thanks for getting me out of trouble with my wife. I hope she's listening. I don't think she is, but...
For sure. LeonardTrialLawyers.com. And Declan, call in next time. We'll have more time next time Mike Leonard's on.